From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's Labor Day. We'll talk to John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, about the state of labor under the Bush administration. And we'll go to Canada, where tens of thousands of workers are taking to the streets in Toronto. And, as usual, live from Durban, South Africa, during this UN World Conference Against Racism, we'll talk to members of South Africa's largest trade union and the Los Angeles Bus Riders Union. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Four bombs exploded in Jerusalem today, slightly injuring five people and overshadowing efforts to arrange talks between Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Despite the explosions, Peres said in a radio interview he might meet Arafat on the sidelines of a three-day business conference near the Italian city of Milan on Friday, in efforts to arrange a ceasefire after nearly a year of violence. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Javier Solana was due to meet Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Arafat separately to try to pave the way for the truce talks. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine claimed responsibility for the blasts a week after Israel assassinated its leader in a missile strike. In related news, Israeli and U.S. officials warned today they might walk out of the United Nations Conference Against Racism, saying that diplomatic efforts aimed at eliminating criticism of Israel from conference documents seem to be failing. The remarks by the U.S. and Israeli officials came after a coalition of rights groups meeting separately presented a report that attacked Israel as, quote, an apartheid regime that had committed, quote, racist crimes against humanity, including ethnic cleansing and acts of genocide in its treatment of Palestinians. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli helicopter gunships today destroyed a Palestinian security services position in Dura at the west entrance of Hebron. And this news from South Africa, diplomats resumed their search today for a deal to prevent a UN racism conference being derailed by sharp divisions over Middle East violence and reparations for the slave trade. The UN meeting entered its fourth day, seeking a way to win over the U.S. delegation, which has objected strongly to a draft declaration that criticizes Israel. Demands by African states for an outright apology and for reparations by former slave trading countries for 400 years of human trafficking have been also resisted by Washington and European states, which fear a rash of possible litigation. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who left the South African port city of Durban on Saturday, has warned the whole event could fail unless these disputes are resolved. North Korea unexpectedly shifted its stance towards South Korea yesterday by announcing it would immediately resume stalled talks with Seoul. Relations between the two Koreas thawed last year, and a historic summit between South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and North Korean leader Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang on June 15, 2000, raised high hopes for reconciliation after half a century of enmity since the 1950-53 Korean War. The South Korean president won the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to bridge the long divide with Pyongyang, but things have since ground to a standstill. Kim Jong-il has held back on a promised return visit to South Korea due to his anger at Washington. This spring, the Bush administration bluntly told South Korea it was not interested in supporting talks between North and South during a visit to Washington by Kim Dae-jung. The United States will brief China on its plans to test a new missile defense system in an effort to win Beijing's acceptance. This, according to a White House spokesperson, U.S. officials will share information on their missile defense plans with the Chinese as part of an outreach effort in preparation for President Bush's trip to Beijing next month, according to a spokesperson for the National Security Council. The spokesperson at the same time denied a report in the New York Times that said the administration is also planning to drop its objections to China building up its small nuclear arsenal in a bid to get Beijing support for U.S. missile defense. Arms analysts estimate China has about two dozen nuclear missiles capable of reaching the U.S. The spokesperson also denied reports in both newspapers that said as part of the new effort, the United States and China might also discuss resuming underground nuclear tests to ensure the reliability of their arsenals. in proposing a missile defense system. Bush has cited the threat from countries like Iraq and Iran and is eager to deploy a shield, including missiles launched from ships and lasers fired from modified Boeing 747 aircraft. But the plans would violate the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty and have been firmly resisted by China, Russia, and many European allies who fear a renewed arms race. And members of Minnesota's largest state employees union this weekend authorized a strike that could affect universities, parks, and prisons across the state. A union negotiating team last month rejected the state's offer of a modest pay increase and recommended its 19,000 members walk off the job. The union has asked for a larger annual raise and increased insurance. Results announced Saturday showed union members voted 90% in favor of the strike, which could begin September 17th. Governor Jesse Ventura has stood behind the state's offer, saying employees should be happy in a climate of corporate layoffs. And a U.S. consumer group and a labor union today made a Labor Day appeal to the government to protect workers' health by lowering the permissible exposure to beryllium, a metal linked to a fatal lung disease. Beryllium is commonly used in the manufacture of sporting goods, dental equipment, and airplane parts. Workers can inhale beryllium fumes or dust during manufacturing, and exposure can lead to chronic beryllium disease, a lung condition with symptoms of weakness, fatigue, and respiratory or heart failure. Consumer group Public Citizen and the paper Allied Industrial Chemical and Energy Workers International Union petitioned the government to lower the permissible exposure limit to beryllium from the standard set in 1949.
Now please come to the crossroads. You can save the children I know.
My Blood, Neville Brothers, Yellow Moon, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman as we go live to Durban, South Africa, in what's believed to be the biggest protest since the end of white rule in 1994. Close to 2 million South African workers last week participated in a two-day general strike against the privatization of public services. The strike, called by the Congress of South African Trade Unions, or COSATU, has shaken the ruling so-called tripartite alliance between the dominant African National Congress, the South African Communist Party, and COSATU. Tensions between the three mounted after the ANC took power with the first multiracial democratic elections in 1994. According to critics, the ANC gave way too much to multinational corporations in an attempt to lure international investors. Now some say the ANC has sold out and is just towing the neoliberal line. Today on Labor Day, we're joined by COSATU's chief education officer, as well as Los Angeles Bus Riders Union member Eric Mann, who is in Durban for the conference and marched with the COSATU workers last week. Joining us in the studios in Durban, South Africa, is Malengi Bengu, COSATU's chief education officer. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk about the protest of last Friday? And I'd also ask if the engineer could take out the mic of Eric Mann so that we can really hear Malengi Bengu for the beginning of this conversation. Tell us about this two-day strike and why you chose to do it exactly the time of the World Conference Against Racism taking place in Durban.
Well, what is important to spell out from the onset is that COSATU, for a very long time, alongside other working class formations in South Africa, have been engaging government and other elements of the state regarding the best way in which we need to build the capacity of the state. And obviously it would be argued that one of the best ways of doing so is to manage properly the assets that are owned by the state, which is what the strike was about. And these discussions have been taking place for a very long time, actually for years, about a framework within which the restructuring of the state-owned enterprises as part and parcel of the democratization and the de-racialization of South African society have to be managed. So it wasn't just a once-off decision to hold the strike during the proceedings of the World Conference Against Racism. There are key issues around which government and labor have not found one another. And we don't see this as simply just an economic strike. It is also about defending the rights of the South African majority who struggled for many years so that they have access to water, electricity, food and bread in their stomachs. It's not just about narrow shop floor questions. Well, of course, we would do that as trade unions, but this time around, it is a strike around which we want to mobilize the entirety of South African society and the other global forces so that we intensify struggles against privatization wherever it takes place, not only in South Africa.
Now, the government of South Africa beseeched COSATU not to have this strike at the time of the conference. It just finished up before the conference began. Why did COSATU stand firm on the date?
Well, I think that, obviously our view is the Federation supported and mandated by the 2 million members that we have, as well as the broader support base that COSATU enjoys in South African society, had to stand firm because we know that even though we have achieved formal political democracy since 1994, and I mark my words, when I use the word formal political democracy, it simply means that without transforming the economy, building a strong developmental and democratic state, without that formal political democracy remains hollow. So we've got to intensify that struggle. We have struggled for an ANC-led government. We will continue to support it, but we will defend workers and the entire working class whenever we think that their interests are being undermined. And we certainly think that government's policy on privatization, which they call restructuring of state-owned enterprises, rolls back a number of struggles that workers of this country have led.
We're talking to Malengi Bengu, Chief Education Officer for COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, live in Durban, South Africa, where the UN World Conference Against Racism is taking place. Malengi Bengu, COSATU has, though, agreed to limited privatization in the past. Can you talk about that, as has the South African Communist Party?
Yes, I think, firstly, it's very important to explain the point. And the point is really that there are aspects of what is known as state-owned enterprises or public enterprises, as we could normally call them in South Africa, that would include organizations or companies such as Transnet, which is responsible for rail and transport, Spornet, which is responsible for rail, Portnet, responsible for harbors, Eskom, responsible for electricity, and Telkom, responsible for telecommunications. These are just examples of very huge state-owned enterprises that command a lot of capital that could be best used to support development. Now, we also have other state-owned enterprises such as Aventura, which is responsible for tourism, holidays, etc., etc., managing holidays, holiday resorts, etc. Now, obviously, COSATU's fixation is really with the kinds of state-owned enterprises which provide the services that are really basic for human survival and for sustainable livelihood, and the kinds of state-owned enterprises that will contribute to ensuring that we deliver water to people, clean water, we deliver sanitation, we deliver food, and we think those are very basic. We deliver electricity to a majority of rural people that have never had access to electricity for a very long time. And we're saying that those kinds of enterprises, under no circumstances should they be privatized, because once they're privatized, the interests of private enterprises is different from the interests of what should be the interests of an emerging national democratic state, which is what we are still fighting for. We haven't achieved that as yet. That's different from Aventura, which may have auxiliary services that it manages. And we think that in the interest of managing state-owned enterprises, restructuring is in order. Restructuring is in order because the apartheid state had no interest in providing services and basic services to people, and certainly to the black majority. Now that we are having to expand the mandate of these state-owned enterprises so that they are able to cater from the historically oppressed black majority, there is a need for some form of restructuring so that they are efficient and they are able to work effectively. Now, that is really where we are. We're not hung up on an ideological conception of privatization, which is usually interpreted to mean that everything must never be thrown to the private sector. The private sector can handle administration of some of those holiday resorts, in our view. But we think that you cannot hand over management or of the delivery of electricity to the majority of South Africans. So, and I think that those two services, tourism and, you know, water delivery or water supply, are qualitatively different from the point of view of a country that has been ravaged by the scourge of poverty and inequality. For a majority of us, a tourist facility is very luxurious, and we think that we need to start there. We can have a discussion later on down the line about how we manage our tourism. Obviously, we know it's an important income generator. And obviously, I'm just picking up on one example. So we're not supporting privatization, but we're saying that what is known as non-core assets could be privatized, could be commercialized, and you should look at a menu of options and not only confine ourselves to this classical privatization as it has been seen elsewhere. So that is really where we stand. And we're saying that with water, electricity, the telecom, for instance, installation of telephones, those should not be left to the private sector, because the private sector in South Africa and globally has proved that they're not interested in making a dent or contributing to a fight against poverty and inequality. And so we've been very consistent on that line. In fact, we mobilized workers to vote for the ANC on the basis of basic service delivery that is going to be driven and led by the state, that is strong, that builds, continues to build its capacity so that it is able to deliver efficient services to our people.
Malengi Bengu, what role does the World Bank and the IMF play in these issues of privatization?
Well, as you would know, South Africa is increasingly assuming some center stage within the global community, but more particularly within the financial institutions that you've just referred to. And we're saying that the policies that we have committed ourselves politically through the manifestos when we go and vote as South Africans and as a new government are largely inconsistent with the policies that we support within the WTO, within the IMF, and within the World Bank. And we're calling on our government to actually use its own influence within those structures to challenge what is taking place there. We know, for instance, that the privatization is largely shaped and influenced by the neoliberal framework that South Africa, as a component of the UN system and a number of these financial institutions, has not been able to challenge in the manner in which we would like to see that happening. But we know that, in fact, we can't just make calls. We've got to mobilize our workers, our members. We've got to mobilize workers in general and other social formations in South Africa so that, in fact, we build a strong mass movement in this country that is able to consistently engage our own government and support our government where we think they are taking on a progressive path that not only benefits South Africa but benefits a majority of the world's working people.
Malengi Bengu of COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions in Durban, South Africa. I'm going to put off our break for a few minutes, warn our stations around the country, because we're also joined by Eric Mann, who is sitting next to Malengi Bengu in Durban, South Africa, at the UN World Conference Against Racism. He's a member of the planning committee of the Los Angeles Bus Riders Union and director of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Durban for the conference, spent 10 years as United Auto Workers Assembly line worker in the United States. Eric Mann, you are part of the COSATU March. I read one of your commentaries online that you put out, the COSATU General Strike and the Treachery of the International Marketplace. Can you talk about the connections you see between what's going on in South Africa and what you see in Los Angeles?
Well, first of all, on a very positive note, the Ninth Circuit of the Western courts ruled yesterday to uphold the Bus Riders Union civil rights case against the Los Angeles MTA, which is a tremendous victory for the civil rights movement in the United States against the Scalia courts and so forth. So that's just a very fortunate development as I'm in Durban. But marching with the workers in COSATU, one of the things I was thinking about a lot is the tremendous pressure that they're under and how the debate gets framed. Should Mbeki do this and should COSATU do this? And the United States is outside the debate when, in fact, the United States' hands are all over this World Conference Against Racism. The United States, in my opinion, subverted the NGO conference, and it's in the process of subverting the UN conference. And one of the things I was thinking about is that if we developed, and I mean this seriously, a demand for reparations in the United States and dealt with the transatlantic slave trade, it would delegitimize the United States government at a time, and it would take pressure off the South African government so that they could have a genuine self-determination. Because to ask what Mbeki should do inside the IMF and the World Bank assumes that South Africa is the equal of the United States in these international arenas. When the United States threatens to withdraw capital, when the United States threatens to withdraw loans, when Mercedes threatens that if you go on strike, we're going to pull the capital out of South Africa, I think that people in the United States should be focusing more on the U.S. government's policies than engaging in internal debates about what the South African working class should do. And the last thing I just want to say is it was pretty incredible to march with 40 or 50,000 workers in South Africa teaching us Zulu chants, teaching us dance steps, and seeing the way that the working class is received in this country, seeing posters that say national liberation and socialism. And if I could add, one of the great things at the City Hall of Durban is several of the COSATU members said, look, we don't have socialism now, but how can we move towards socialism if we give away the state assets? It's not just a question of what's the best way to run it. The black working class has taken power in South Africa, at least a little bit. And one of the things it has is state assets. So I think what was exciting to me when you discussed the AFL-CIO in the United States, by contrast, I'm very sad about the narrowness of U.S. labor politics and very deeply moved by the broadness of COSATU's politics in South Africa.
Eric Mann, we're going to be going to John Sweeney in just 1 minute, who in fact is in Los Angeles today and then headed up to Northern California. But in terms of your own struggle, the LA Bus Riders Union, can you talk about what's happening there as it relates to issues of privatization?
In fact, when I was here, it even helped me understand our own issue better because, as for instance, the issue in Los Angeles quickly is that the state, instead of privatizing itself, has essentially become a vehicle for private capital. So what's happened in Los Angeles is the MTA has moved $3 billion in money to boondoggle rail projects to go out to the white suburbs and has bled the inner city bus system for 400,000 overwhelmingly minority bus riders. And I thought about it and I realized that this is a different form of privatization. Rather than taking capital outside the state, it's using state capital to help construction companies, rail companies, black and Latino bourgeois contractors. Essentially, it's diverting the surplus away from the working class towards the privileged classes in the United States. It's a very classic, in some ways, IMF development model, a structural adjustment. And I think in marching with the COSATU workers, I realized we have to use those expressions better in LA. We've said fight transit racism, but I think we also have to say fight structural adjustment, fight the seizure of state assets, as COSATU is saying. And the other thing I want to say is that we have to really get our dance steps better, you know, because we're pretty good in L.A., but I think I learned a lot of stuff here that I want to bring back about a kind of vibrant mass movement that we've built. So I think what's exciting about COSATU is that I think people in communities of color inside the United States, whether it be New York, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, should start using more explicit third world terminology, not rhetorically, but analytically, to explain that our cities really are third world cities inside a first world country.
Well, Eric Mann, member of the planning committee of the LA Bus Riders Union in Durban for the UN World Conference Against Racism, joining with COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and Malengi Bengu, chief education officer, this past week in the two-day general strike that was held in South Africa, in Durban. I want to thank you both for being with us. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, as we continue our coverage in Durban, we will be talking with people at the conference around the issue of reparations for slavery and colonialism. And we'll be talking about the situation of India's Dalit, or untouchable caste, with three Dalits from India. You're listening to Democracy Now! Next up on this Labor Day special, we'll speak with the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney. Stay with us.